Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
Ladies and gentlemen, please remain standing for the singing of our national anthem.
Brexit means Brexit.
My administration has accomplished more than almost any administration in the history of our country.
Hello and welcome to Mid-Atlantic, the show where we look at the news and the views from one side of the Atlantic from the perspective of the other. I'm Royfield Brown, who's in the Bay Area today, that is bedecked by a cloudless blue sky. Ah, it's spring. Today, we have a changing of the guard. I'm joined by author and constitutional law scholar, Corey Brettschneider, who's written some kind of book. What book have you written, Corey? I just couldn't remember the name of it.
It's called The Oath in the Office. Oh. And it's a guide to the Constitution for future presidents. Everything you need to know about the Constitution if you want to be president of the United States. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, as you could guess, everything that this president does not know.
Oh, I'm guessing that for somebody like Cory Booker or Kamala Harris, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, this is bedside reading at the moment.
I don't know. I mean, I think there is a real question in this country whether or not I think it should be, of course, I should say. And for Donald Trump, there's an audiobook, so he can listen to that, you know, he doesn't read. Not that that he's likely to be able to stay focused. But I think the real question about these candidates is whether or not they are in some ways going to continue in the tradition of Trump, in the sense of disregarding the rule of law, the process, with an aim towards achieving their policy goals. And you know, there's a tradition in this country, you know, the Debs tradition of not loving the Constitution. So my worry, frankly, is that some of the candidates that I might otherwise like Sanders, I have suspicions about, although I'm not sure, you know, it's still time to tell.
Corey, let me jump in.
Yep.
You've gone off too soon, sir. You've gone into the topic of the show. We're still doing the introductions. You give me full and frank, thought-out answers. Don't do that just yet. All right. And on the other side of the land...
I'm just a wordy professor.
You are. But, Corey, where exactly are you, by the way?
I'm at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island.
Oh, okay, so Providence, Rhode Island. And then in London... On the greyer side of the Atlantic, we have Emma Burnell. Say hello, folks.
Hello.
Corey, you missed your mark, sir.
Hello.
All right, good. Now, Emma, considering that Corey went on at length about his works and you are new to the show, so why don't you tell us exactly what you do?
So I am a political journalist and political consultant. And I do what people pay me to do, mostly. I write a lot of articles, usually about the Labour Party, quite often tearing my hair out. Mm-hmm. And then I de-stress by writing about anything else, including theatre, which is one of my loves.
As it is mine also. But maybe we can talk about that in takeaways of the week. In a week that has seen the Cleveland Browns announce their intention to win the Super Bowl by signing Odell Beckham Jr., and the UK government admitting that Spotify and Netflix could be blocked to UK citizens on holiday in Europe in the event of a no deal. Just when will this Brexit madness stop? We ask, what will the immediate political future hold in Blighty and in the land of opportunity?
On a point of order, Mr. Speaker. I profoundly regret the decision that this House has taken tonight. I continue to believe that by far the best outcome is that the United Kingdom leaves the European Union in an orderly fashion with a deal. And that the deal we've negotiated is the best and indeed the only deal available. But Mr. Speaker, I would like to set out briefly how the government means to proceed. 2 weeks ago, I made a series of commitments from this dispatch box regarding the steps we would take in the event that this House rejected the deal on offer. I stand by those commitments in full. Therefore, tonight we will table a motion for debate tomorrow to test whether the House supports leaving the European Union without a deal on the 29th of March. The Leader of the House will shortly make an emergency business statement confirming the change to tomorrow's business. This is an issue of grave importance for the future of our country. Just like the referendum, there are strongly held and equally legitimate views on both sides. For that reason, I can confirm that this will be a free vote on this side of the House. I have personally struggled with this choice, as I'm sure many other honourable members will. I'm passionate about delivering the result of the referendum, but I equally passionately believe that the best way to do that is to leave in an orderly way with a deal. And I still believe that there is a majority in the House for that course of action.
Emma, Theresa May says that she understands the voice of the country. Quite simply, does she? What is the mood of the country at the moment? And give us an idea of the Brexit arithmetic in Parliament.
The Brexit arithmetic in Parliament is probably the slightly easier question in that nothing quite adds up. There is a majority to stop almost every option. There is no majority to take anything forward. So we've got a lot of people in Parliament saying, well, we don't really want that, i.e. last night we had another vote where she tried to bring back her deal. And Parliament voted it down again by a smaller but still significant majority. And they're voting today. They will almost certainly vote today to say no deal should be off the table. Now, that's all very well, but that's like me saying, voting to say that I should only weigh 8 stone. It's a lovely idea, but it's not my default. So no deal is what happens if we don't have anything else to say to go to, and if we don't extend. So tomorrow there'll be another vote on whether we should extend Article 50. That, of course, is not our choice. We would have to ask the European Parliament if they're willing to let us extend Article 50.
But surely, though, Emma, they're going to say yes, because they're not at all frustrated or pissed off by us in this whole process, are they?
No, you know, they are so pleased with how we're comporting ourselves. they are impressed, bowled over, I would say. No, I mean, the problem is they're not willing to give us another 3, 6, whatever months just to keep doing the same thing. So if we want to extend, there has to be a reason. That reason either has to be that there is a deal we can get that will get passed through Parliament. That doesn't seem to be on the cards at the moment. That there is going to be a general election, or that there's going to be a second referendum, a final say.
Is there another possibility, which is that or maybe this is part of the possibility of the new Parliament, that it just decides to remain as a result of the election and whatever.
There are people talking about revoking Article 50, because there is also talk within that the European Parliament would say no to an extension. If to avoid a no deal, we would then have to revoke Article 50. But that could be re-invoked at a time that we'd actually worked out what the hell it was we were asking for. So basically, we triggered Article 50 way, way too soon. I mean, for me, any time in my lifetime is too soon, to be fair. But we shouldn't have triggered Article 50 until we had a much, much clearer idea of what it was that we wanted, but also that we could get the European Union to agree to. So it's possible that they may revoke. If there's a second referendum and it were won by Remain, then that would automatically trigger a revoking of Article 50.
let's just say that there is some kind of temporary revoking or an extension. Emma, are we not going to see the wrath of at least some parts of the, I was going to say British, but I'll scratch that, English electorate, saying that the politicians couldn't come to a decision, there were hard choices to be made, democracy be damned, they've driven a coach and horses through the will of some elements, some very vocal elements of the English electorate.
You are, I think whatever happens, that's where the public is at. The public are a combination of frustrated and bored, which, as anyone who's taught, you know, young kids knows, is never a good thing. They are desperate for the politicians to just get on with it. Even the Remainers want some sort of way out of where we are at the moment. But the problem is that they have also been told that pretty much anything that isn't a very, very hard Brexit is a betrayal. So there are going to be people who, no matter what Brexit looks like, will consider that to be the case and will be up in arms. So the idea that this is all going to be settled and sorted at the end of a process is for the birds, really.
Can I ask you a question about the, I mean, this is a sort of pulling back question from an outsider very much, but the assumption often is that the democratic thing to do is to follow the referendum. But my understanding of the legal status of Parliament is that it can't cede its sovereignty, right? Parliament is sovereign. So any promise that this was going to be binding, to me, I mean, this is a blunt way of putting it, was a lie. It's Parliament that's going to make the decision in the end.
The idea
of deferring to this referendum, which isn't part of your legal process, is advisory at best. I don't see why you're bound by it at all.
You're speaking as a constitutional scholar, not a politician. the people in Parliament, technically, yes. I mean, we don't really have a constitution, right. Certainly not in the way that you guys do.
Right.
But also, you know, you can say advisory referendum until you're blue in the face.
Right.
But in terms of honouring the democratic process that gets them into Parliament every 5 years, you know, they will lose their seats. Or some of them feel that they will lose their seats. Now, that actually is not necessarily true. There is some research that says, particularly in the Labour seats where they voted leave, that despite those seats voting a majority leave, their Labour voters voted majority remain. So it's incredibly complicated, but the political answer is that nobody considered that an advisory referendum, and it was not treated as such, and the government said, we will implement it, largely because the government very arrogantly assumed it would win.
It is just such a terrible decision-making procedure to do anything by referendum. I'm such an opponent of it. And there's a reason why we have representative democracy. It's to avoid exactly this, and you're all learning it the hard way, I'm afraid.
Yeah, and we keep doing it to ourselves.
But you know what, though? I'm sat in the state of the prop, you know, so there are referenda in many states in the United States, and California is in large part kind of governed by various propositions that are put on ballot papers. So we're hardly unique in that regard.
But it's a terrible, terrible part of our system, I think. And for the same reason, you know, when we've used it, it's often gone awry. So Colorado at one point puts gay rights up for a vote and passes this terrible amendment to their constitution that, you know, says basically you don't have rights of employment or rights in housing, rights to be a teacher. And it's only our Supreme Court in that instance that saves us. And California, I guess I'd say the same thing, that the sort of decimation of the California state education system was largely through, you know, tax reform, what's called tax reform. But responsible legislatures, you know, it's up to representatives to sort of, I think, keep us from the worst instincts that you get from referenda. You get very little good reform, I think, that way. You get uneducated votes, often manipulated by rich people. And, you know, I think you're seeing the hugest example maybe in world history in Brexit, but there are many within our system too. I mean, you're right. It's part of our system, but it's a terrible part, I think.
Yeah. Listen, Yeah, you're completely right. And you see that played out on the very local level in American politics all the time, with affluent parts of cities seceding from wider municipality bodies and stuff because of direct democracy, so to speak. So they take the tax base away. And that happens all the time kind of in the United States because of that type of thing on a local level. But the one thing I'll just come back and say that I slightly disagree with you, Emma, with a little bit of in terms of the nuance of actually what you said. Because you said that this wasn't treated as an advisory vote. I would say for Remainers it actually was, because the way that they very casually had that campaign back in 2016, they didn't exactly put their backs into it. And also, and even by the Leavers, in that there was no solid definite direction of travel in terms of what leave meant, that it was all in hindsight taken as a little bit of a lark, in that this is not going to pass. Nobody thought that we were ever going to vote to leave, and there were not concrete proposals about Northern Ireland. Nobody thought about Northern Ireland. The DUP didn't even think about Northern Ireland back then. And you had staunch leavers now saying things like, no one's talking about leaving the single market, because nobody actually thought that it was actually going to pass. So whilst I agree to in large part that this wasn't, we had to say it's an advisory vote for constitutional reasons and stuff, but actually we did, in large part, the political establishment did treat it as such.
I don't know that they treated it as an advisory vote. They treated it as a foregone conclusion that it turned out to be wrong. So, yeah, they did. I mean, the Remain campaign was dreadful. They made a lot of mistakes. There's a very good series of blogs on the Open Labour website. I am co-chair of Open Labour, so I should just announce that. By Oliver Coppard, who worked for the Remain campaign, and he's sort of done some really interesting soul searching on what they got wrong. So I highly recommend those. But the there were so many questions that were actually asked during that referendum that everybody who voted was probably answering a slightly different question, and they certainly weren't necessarily answering the question on the ballot paper. And that's the problem, because there are a million different flavours of leave. And there were actually several different flavours of Remain. We just only offered them the one.
What are the different flavours? If I walked in, like, to a grocery store and you see all the Ben and Jerry's kind of lined up, what do we get? Less shit, more shit, real shit and bad shit. Are these the flavours of Leave?
That's pretty much it, okay. Yeah. I mean, there's the Leave a little tiny bit, but stay in the customs union and single market. So basically keep all of the economic benefits, but be a rule taker rather than a rule maker.
So sovereignty goes completely out the window with that.
So that's basically what you lose there is sovereignty, but what you gain is the we don't take the bigger economic hit.
There is no gain, because it's just a continuum of where we are.
It's a gain from the other options. So then there's the stay in the customs union but leave the single market. Yeah. That way you have freedom of movement ends, you have more control over your borders, but you still have to take the trade rules.
And you have to pay for the privilege as well.
Sorry, say again?
We're still going to have to pay for the privilege. We still have to throw some money to Brussels for that.
Well, we will be paying some money to Brussels unless we do an actual hard Brexit, and even then we have to pay our current obligations, because they'll sue us, and we would both then have to pay all their money and the court costs. But we want to be part of some of the things in the EU come what may. Things like Euratom, which is how we transport nuclear materials, incredibly important for, say, cancer patients who need radiation therapy. We need to stay a part of that organisation. That organisation needs to be funded. We would pay for some of that funding. So no matter what happens, some money will be leaving the UK shores and going into Europe.
Emma, isn't part of the problem here, I'm going to say a large part of the problem, is that we live in a world now, and it's echoed in America with the rise of Trump, the rise of the Tea Party and then Trump, that people want simple solutions to complex problems, right? Don't give me the detail. Don't hear from an expert. Mm. This is what I want, okay? And the problem is with Remain is inherent in that it's not an easy sell. Other than saying, let's put our hands around our European brethren and whatever, and let's just cuddle them. And if we cuddle them tightly, we'll probably not go back to war as we did 70 years ago, right? It's a harder sell, isn't it? Because it is things like, oh, we've got a European space agency, right? We've committed to spending X amount of money on that. We're going to continue to do that because research is good.
Right.
Yeah.
And I mean, it all speaks to too why the referendum is such a terrible way to do this, because it's just too complicated for people to process it in a way that's going to lead to a up or down vote. And I think that's the role of representatives, is to do the processing and to, you know, campaign on values maybe and broad principles, but to know the details of the policy and its ins and outs. And the idea that that was left up to the country in this moment of voting, I think, is a disaster. I mean, why could you not campaign that way? This is a naive question, maybe on the political question, instead of keeping it at this conceptual level. But what about a campaign that just said that these people have made a historic mistake for the next parliament, that the campaign would go, I guess Labour's campaign could say, this is a historic mistake. It's an embarrassment in the world. We were lied to and told that it was binding.
Corey,
and we're going to remain.
Corey. Not possible? You're going to tell people that they were stupid. You can't do that.
Yeah, that basically is the problem.
Yeah.
You know, you were stupid, change your mind is really not the world's most persuasive argument.
not the decision, the process.
The reason that all of those card games you see on the streets in films work is because people do not want to believe that they're capable of being duped. And this is Three Card Monty, just on a really big scale.
But don't they know they were duped at this point?
No, absolutely not. No. They are 100% convinced. Absolutely.
These are articles of faith. There's so many articles of faith here, not a fact. And one of the things which I don't think gets, at least from the outside world looking in at Britain, what a lot of people don't realise is that from the 1980s, when Thatcher was still in power, there's been a steady diet of misinformation told to the British public by some right-wing newspapers, of which the Daily Mail and the Sun would be the chief culprits. So you have people saying that and believing it, because I've been hearing this for 30 plus years, that the European Union is trying to straighten our bananas.
Yeah.
This is a real thing, Corey. Yeah. You've got to understand, there's been headline after headline saying things like up yours Delors, and Jack Delors was the ex-head of the, you know, European Parliament, etc. And people believe that...
you want to get rid of, they want to get rid of pint glasses.
Exactly. That, you know, they want to get rid of British plugs. This is a serious thing for some people. And you say, but they haven't done it, and then they're stumped.
People go mad about the colour of their passport, honestly.
Exactly. Yeah. We have to have a debate which is slightly away from the exact machinations which will happen in Parliament in the next 2 days, because we're going to be held a hostage to fortune if we really go down that route. So this has been a good way of us to talk about Brexit without going into the detail. Quickly, Emma, what has been the effect of the independent group on shaping Labour's attitudes towards a second referendum? Because to me, it seems like they have given them a little bit of a nudge, but now they're a fart in the wind and they're gone.
Yeah, I mean, Tig gave the Labour leadership a massive scare. There may be others that would still go and are being kept in because the leadership moved on a second referendum. They seem to have wobbled a little bit on that in the last couple of days, but they've been... Keir Starmer just stood up and clarified in Parliament that Labour is very much in favour now of pursuing a second referendum. That's not the only reason people were leaving and wanted to leave. You know, the Labour Party is having a terrible crisis over anti-Semitism at the moment. And more widely about just the culture of party meetings, party events, which have become very divided. It's a party that's very, very split. And that's really hard to take when you're on the sharp end of it. And MPs are on the particularly sharp end of it. Some of the people who went off to the independent group had been threatened with deselections. So they were like, well, I'm going to lose my job anyway. Might as well stick with my principles and get out of this toxic atmosphere.
I was going to quickly just jump in there, Emma, because there obviously is a parallel to do with anti-Semitism. Mm. Where does anti-Semitism start and end, and where does legitimate criticism of the state of Israel start and end over in the States? Corey, could you give us a little bit of your take on the Democratic Party's issue to do with new Congress people being, let's say, quite strident in their anti-Israeli views, and how the Democratic Party establishment has maybe dealt with that in the last week?
There was a controversy that surrounded remarks about the influence specifically of AIPAC, the Israel, there are two Israeli lobbying groups in the United States that openly lobby and have membership organizations about Israel policy. One is the biggest and the oldest, called AIPAC, and the other is called J Street. And AIPAC has had, according to this one representative that caused the controversy, an outsized influence. And in particular, it was a tweet that I don't want to try to quote it because I don't want to get it wrong, but it involved the phrase all about the Benjamins, that it, you know, there was a financial basically reason for this group having such success when it came to its views on Israel policy. And then that was met with a very strong response from people on the right, but also within the Democratic Party, charging that this was anti-Semitic. And so there was a proposed resolution of condemnation that then a lot of people said, well, what about Trump, basically? What about the right wing? What about the rise of bigotry more generally in the country? And so what the Democrats opted for was a more general resolution condemning, I don't know exactly how it was worded, but it was condemning bigotry more generally, you know, including, of course, anti-Semitism, anti-Muslim bigotry. And so that's where we are. And yes.
Okay, let's just end up, because time is pressing. One last question to you, Emma.
Mm-hmm.
Parliament is going to assess its supremacy, which is something that Corey reminded us of at the start of the show, that Parliament is sovereign. So its supremacy is trumps that of the executive. And this has been underlined now by Theresa May saying that she's going to give Tory MPs a free vote in subsequent Brexit amendments. Who will be the important members of Parliament in shaping our policy and our trajectory towards Brexit? Who should we look out for?
The things to look out for, I would say the Kyle Wilson compromise is something that you really want to look out for. That is a suggestion that's coming from, I think it's two Labour MPs, it might be one Labour, one Tory, saying we will agree to pass your deal through Parliament if you agree to a confirmatory referendum on it. So it's saying, look, let's get to a point where we know we're not going to get no deal, and then we'll either get your deal or remain. And then we, but that goes back to the people. Mm-hmm. So watch what happens with that, because that is seen by some as the kind of the best way to get both a deal at all and a second referendum. So the people who are pure, I just want a second referendum, will probably consider it as a compromise. The people who are pure, I want something to I want Brexit to happen, but I don't want a hard Brexit, I don't want no deal Brexit, might consider it a compromise. And then if it goes back to the country, so that, look out for the Kyle Wilson amendment whenever that comes up. The people to watch are the people that we've been watching. Dominic Grieve on the Conservative side for the Remainers. David Davis changed his mind and voted in favour of May's deal, which is very interesting because he was the first to leave May's cabinet over Chequers, which is what this deal basically is. So he's clearly been on a bit of a journey, so he's worth watching. Watch what Labour do. Watch not just whether they whip, but what the consequences of breaking that whip might be. So there are going to be some people, even in the shadow cabinet or shadow junior ministers, who will not follow the whip. Now, normally, convention would have it that they should lose their jobs. If they don't, then that's a message from the Labour leadership that they don't really mean it. So watch that. That's worth watching very closely. So it's not necessarily just who, because the who in the Labour Party is always Jeremy Corbyn and Keir Starmer, obviously on Brexit. But also the what.
Okay. All right. Let's move from Blighty, as we said, to the land of milk and honey and utter economic opportunity.
Coca-Cola.
That is the exactly. Diet Coca-Cola,
even. I don't know which
country
is in more of a dire crisis. It's really hard to tell. I still think I might vote for us.
Yeah, well, there was a meme that went around the UK. So we passed Brexit earlier than you elected Trump. So in November 2016, there was a meme that went around the UK, which is the UK saying, we're going to do the most stupid thing ever. And America's like, hold my pint.
Hold my beer. Yeah, I share that. I mean, because at least you don't have, you know, you have a bad, I would say historically bad decision in Brexit.
Absolutely.
In that moment. But you don't have leaders saying what we have our and, you know, our chief executive, the president of the United States, saying, which is continually an assault on everything that is basic to democracy. And every day.
Well, we do have
Stop
a prime minister.
Do us. Typical American braggadocio. We've done it worse than you. Stop it.
We do have a prime minister whose punchline is Brexit means Brexit. But yeah, what does that
mean? That is
very
true.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Former Vice President Joe Biden leads the 2020 Democratic field in a key state, though he has yet to announce his run for president. A new very early poll shows 27% of likely Democratic caucus goers in Iowa picked Biden. He has a 2-point lead over Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. Ed O'Keefe is in Austin, Texas, where some of the Democratic hopefuls spoke out over the weekend. Ed, good morning.
The former vice president isn't expected to get in for a few more weeks, and those poll numbers might actually encourage him to do so. But the other Democrats already in the race now trying to make sure that Biden doesn't steal their thunder.
It's 2020 contenders at South by Southwest in Austin tried to avoid bringing more attention to the possibility of former Vice President Biden getting into the fray.
Well, I have a lot of respect for Vice President Biden, and first we want to make sure he's getting in. But I can only address my own merit.
Why are you better, more qualified, more worthy of support than the former vice president?
I'm in this race because Washington works great for the wealthy and the well-connected. It's just not working for anyone else.
Meanwhile, Senator Bernie Sanders campaigned Sunday in New Hampshire.
We are going to complete what we started here.
Sanders, campaigning for president a second time, is once again forcing a conversation among Democrats about socialism.
Now, we have potentially to come Vice President Joe Biden and the former Texas U.S. Representative Beto O'Rourke. But here are, I'm going to take a deep breath, the Democratic runners and riders declared for 2020. John Hickenlooper, Jay Inslee, Bernie Sanders, Amy Klobuchar, Elizabeth Warren, Cory Booker, Kamala Harris, Julian Castro, Tulsi Gabbard, John Delaney, Marianne Wilson, Andrew Yang, Kirsten Gillibrand, Pete Buttigieg. Now, which one of those sends a shiver up your leg, Corey?
Oh, I think in all seriousness, we're in such a crisis with this president that anybody who would win on that list, none of them send a shiver up my leg. There is no question that we could draw at random from that list and we would be light years ahead of where we are now. And, you know, the discussion here, too, is about whether to focus on whoever this new person is in the policy debate or whether or not to try to impeach Trump and take him down first to, you know, either soften him up for the election.
Stop guessing where I'm going with my questions. Stop where I am right now. Now,
you want me to pick?
Pick one now, and then I'm going to ask
you
a question.
I mean it about fear. I don't see anybody on that list that is that
incompetent.
That place us in a much better position. So I honestly couldn't single anyone out. I mean, I did mention that Sanders has made remarks in the past that I worry about because, and I'll say why. The current controversy over the state of emergency is a symbol of what's going on here, in that the president's used legislation to abuse it to get a policy outcome that he was denied by the Congress. And in our system, you know, we don't have the sovereignty of Parliament. We have co-equal branches. But when the Congress says no, the core law of the Constitution says the president can't override that and simply, through using executive orders, go against congressional legislation. Now, Trump has done that in the Wall case. And one controversy now is whether or not the Democrats, if they should take the White House, should do the same thing, use emergency powers to do environmental reform or the Green New Deal. And I guess of all of the people on the list, I want to know if Sanders is very clear that that's not something that he would do. There are, I think, among the left in this country, a sort of belief that
you think Sanders has got the potentiality of authoritarian government in him, do you?
Well, it's not authoritarian government, right? It's using legislation that's on the books in an abusive way. I guess that's what I would call it, for good purposes. And that's okay. Very different than, Trumpism, which is using legislation on the books for fake emergencies that aren't there for authoritarian purposes, bigoted purposes. So I don't think that if Sanders did what I'm talking about, it has the same kind of gravity. But I want to see candidates agree that even for good purposes, they're not going to abuse the process. And yes, I'm not sure.
I'm
not sure generally, and I'm certainly not sure about Sanders.
While I agree with you, I think it's you need to fix some of the other stuff that makes things not work, because there's a whole bunch of reasons why it's so much harder for Democrats to pass legislation than it is for Republicans. And part of that is your weird two senators, even if you only represent three sheep each, rule. And you've got a whole load of redistricting issues.
You can't fix that, unfortunately. Article 5, this is a interesting, crazy dilemma. There's one thing you can't change, basically, in the United States Constitution, and that's the fact that each state gets two representatives.
True, but there are a couple of workarounds. So you could, you got Puerto Rico, it could be made a state, D.C. could be made a state. So, there are ways of balancing it up a little more.
Right.
There's also the supermajority issue. I am far too much of a geek about this stuff.
Yeah.
So the Des Moines Register and CNN have just conducted a poll, Corey, saying that Joe Biden, if he's to run, will have 27% of the vote of likely Democratic voters, with Bernie Sanders on 25% of those asked. With the diversity of the Democratic field in terms of the number of female candidates running and people of colour, does this mean that American politics is still a country for old white men?
I think
Did you like my movie reference there?
That was very good. I definitely got that.
Yes. I mean, unfortunately, you know, right now we have one old white man that is particularly terrible. Biden would certainly be a better one. To me, Kamala Harris is one of the people to watch who certainly doesn't fit that category. Cory Booker as well.
It would be disappointing to have this incredible field of diverse candidates, all of whom have something to offer. And yeah, I really like Joe Biden. Like, he seems like a sweet guy, old guy, but a sweet guy. And all the memes, the Obama Biden memes were fabulous. And in terms of like politics, I'm probably on the same page roughly as Bernie. You know, in England, we've always been a bit further to the left. And at the moment, we're particularly far to the left. I'm maybe a bit more Warren, somewhere between the two. But it would just be disappointing, I think. And it would feel like what the lesson of 2016 for the Democrats was don't go for a woman. And I think that's just not the right lesson. And I just, it would be disappointing to watch that happen. Now, I would obviously rally behind the candidate and do what I could from a distance, which is basically stay out of it. But, you know, I have this fascination for American politics, but I would love to see the Democrats, you know, go, you know, we're not going to let that one setback make us decide that what we really need is another old white dude.
It's also, I mean, the worry about Biden is there's a sort of recycling effect. You know, we've had Bushes, we've had Clintons, and, you know, Biden is not, it's not a new family member, but a third term that he's part of. That's one worry. But, you know, Obama is the most president, the most popular politician in the country right now. And so that's one effect that he might get is the Obama effect.
Yeah.
My proposal is that Obama run as vice president. There's no constitutional bar on that. so I'd like to see that team of Biden, Obama. That would have an energy. It would get rid of the problem that you're mentioning and maybe would put us back on the right track.
The very fact that we have Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders leading the poll, is that more to do with the fact that this poll is taken in Iowa, one of the whitest states of the US? So hence it's reflected in its answers. Corey, what do you reckon?
You know, I guess my worry about polling generally at this stage is that it's just too early. And, you know, one of the problems with, we were talking, Emma, about how American politics is covered. But, you know, I think one of the worst things that we could do at this stage is just focus on the polls and and what they show, because it's so early. We don't know what the policy positions of these people are. So that's the flaw, I think, in the poll is even talking about it at this stage. We should be focused on what these people want to accomplish.
Oh, completely. No, I completely agree. And, you know, The endless horse race nonsense is, you know, one of the things I like about where the Democrats are at the moment is actually you're having a conversation about policy a lot more than is standard. And you're, in some ways, having these so many candidates, a huge buffet of candidates, is sort of stopping the horse race talk a little bit because they have spread so much between them. And yeah, okay, Biden and Sanders are running away with it a bit at the moment, but that's a name recognition thing as much as anything else. You know, Sanders ran last time. He's got this machine ready to go, and he's already got an inbuilt base of supporters. Joe Biden was the vice president. You know, everybody knows who he is. That's not going to be the case in a year. In a year, everybody who is still really in it, and that won't be the whole 14 or 20 as it gets to, or whatever, we'll have a lot more name recognition. We'll have gone through debates. We'll have been tested. We'll have been putting their ideas out there. So I think as you're right, talking about it now is like, you know, it's as pointless as the endless debates about, oh, where are Labour in the polls? We should be elsewhere. History tells us that Labour should be further ahead in the polls than they
and
are
the
at the moment.
I guess I just add as a final thought, because I've got to run, but the problem in the last election was all this horse race coverage in the midst of somebody who was, you know, making proposals that were, I wouldn't even say borderline fascist. Many of them were
actual out-and-out fascist.
And covering that as though it's, you know, let's talk about how fascism is polling.
Yeah.
That was a huge problem, I think, of how that election was covered.
Completely.
And so not only should we not replicate it early on at this stage, but I'd like to really see a policy focus. you know, the polling is often wrong. There's a lot of arguments about what went wrong last time. But the main thing that's wrong is horse race coverage and not focusing on substance.
Absolutely.
Oh, that last point that Corey made was an interesting one about kind of horse race, kind of politics. Mm-hmm. Oh, today there is definitely a media-driven kind of boom and bust when it comes to candidates. You know, a candidate now, especially in a field of, 15, 17, 20 candidates, I don't know how many there are. So somebody can kind of come from nowhere on kind of media kind of trends, can't they? Do you think we're going to end up with a candidate because of their policies or because their team is really adept at social media, that they're good on Twitter, they can counterpunch, they can take the narrative of the day and craft that into their message?
I think it's going to be a bit of both. I don't think you can, Trump does have policies. They're just terrible policies, but they appeal to a certain amount of the electorate. You have to be able to do both. And you know, I've seen and suffered at the hands of people who were really interesting politically but had no media savvy and just weren't able to lead. And so you can be the most interesting guy in the room policy-wise, but if you can't make a good speech and if you can't counterpunch on Twitter or employ a person who can do that well for you, then you're not going to get anywhere. Equally, if you're all brash and bluster and don't have a policy background, and as I say, I may not like his policies, but Trump has a few signature policies, not least his bloody wall, then you're not going to get anywhere either, because you have to be brash and in the service of something. So I think you've got this huge array of candidates, so it's not like you're not going to find the one that can do both. You'll probably find three or four that can do both and pick your favourite.
I think we should move on to our takeaways of the week, because, listener, Corey had to go because, as he said at the top of the show, he's actually a jobbing professor and he has to go and profess, I believe, right now. So he's gone off and done that. So why don't we go on to our takeaways of the last 7 days with just myself and Emma. Right then, new person. Right, this is your moment to shine, to show us your cultural and intellectual depth away from politics. So tell us
so
one
I should
thing
recommend
in the last
Made in
7
Chelsea,
days.
Then.
Nah. yes, no Made in Chelsea. And who's that dreadful person whose name I can't remember who comes on ITV every morning?
Piers Morgan. I read a lovely book this week called The Cursing Stone. It's a really, really sweet story by a writer called Adrian Harvey, who's actually someone I know, and he's such a great guy. And it's not always the case that when your friend writes a book, you like it. So I'm really glad that I liked this so much. And it's based half on a very remote island in Scotland and half in London. And it's about community and family and the families that you have and the families that you choose. And it's just a really beautiful little book. I don't want to sort of spoil what happens in it, but it's very accessible, very readable. I think I read it in about 3 sessions, and very evocative. Adrian writes really beautifully about both London itself, and there's a love of London that comes through that I really like, because so often you get the sort of anti-London sentiment. So it's really nice to have what feels like a love letter to London written from the perspective of this Scottish outsider who's down to visit for a few weeks, and you know, just finds the city endlessly fascinating. But equally, it's lovely about this beautiful Scottish island, which I now want to go and visit.
What's the
so
island?
That would be my recommendation. Well, in the book, it's called Hinber, but I believe it's actually based on a real place that I can't remember the name of now. But it's one of the Outer Hebrides.
Oh, it does sound absolutely kind of like dreamy. You raise an interesting point there that... singing the praises of London isn't something which kind of happens in our culture anymore, that actually London is a problem. It's not really England. And it was only when I moved to London in 1995 that I realised very quickly that London just happens to be in a country called England. It's not England. Mm. You know, it is so atypical.
Absolutely.
Especially zones 3 into 1. The outer zones, yes, do resemble an England that I know, you know, zones 5 and 6, but 3 to 1, no, you know.
No, absolutely. And I come from a blended family. My brother is mixed race. Mm-hmm. And I remember when my parents moved out of London, it had quite a profound effect on Mike. I remember him saying to my mum and my dad, I think, when I'm in Hackney, people look at me like I'm your son. When I'm in Willing, people look at me like I'm your mugger. And I thought, wow, yeah, that's... And that is 20 miles, 30 miles. You know, really, the difference is, you know, half an hour outside of King's Cross. And the difference is that pronounced. And yet, and that's what makes me so proud of being from London, is that community, that, you know, that blend of everything, that 24-hour living. I love London. But it's the only place in the UK you're not allowed to say you're proud of being from.
You know, that I don't know if I'd quite agree with that, because I think you can say, you at least you used to be able to say, if you were from the East End of London, and I'm on about the old East End, that you definitely were proud of that. And then there are... You know, I'm going to think on about this, Emma, and I'm going to come back. I need to cogitate a little bit more. But you're definitely onto something. But
I mean, it's liberal metropolitan elite thing, and that is just so tied to being from London, that despite there being huge pockets of deprivation, large working class communities here, everyone from London is considered liberal metropolitan elite, no matter what they do or who they are.
Well, but there is another identity signifier in all of this. As somebody who's from Birmingham, you know, so the Midlands, the further south you go, and I would say kind of starts with Birmingham, the less there is of real civic identification, in the way that somebody from Liverpool says, I'm from Liverpool, I'm from Manchester. People don't say, I'm from Basildon. They don't. Right.
No.
You know, people don't say...
Essex, maybe.
Yeah, Essex, maybe. People don't say, I'm from Brighton. You know, there isn't... And I love Brighton. Brighton's a lovely place, right? The further south you get from Birmingham, there is this erosion of English civic identities. People are just like, yeah, I'm just English. I just happen to be brought up in Plymouth. Right. So I think whilst I kind of agree with you, it isn't just all around these relatively new notions of liberal effectiveness to do with London. It is also to do with the fact that, you know, there's 300,000 French nationals in London, 200,000 Italian nationals. It goes on and on and on. And you don't get those demographics in any other English city. But there is also something about regional and civic identity, which is blurred, which is blunted the further south you get. But we should continue this conversation maybe on another Mid-Atlantic, because
absolutely,
because I'm kind of totally fascinated about shifting ideas of identity. But my takeaway of the last 7 days is I saw a great film called The Cold War, and I'm well into a bit of superhero punching. Always have been, ever since I was a little boy. And however, when I was a teenager, I wanted to be a filmmaker, and I wanted to be like a British Derek Jarman. That's actually who I wanted to be. I wanted to make artsy-fartsy films and stuff. And I've been watching too many superhero films recently. I don't regret it, and I love Captain Marvel. I will be watching The Avengers. But it was really nice for me actually to go and see an art house indie film in another language, subtitles, so it's Polish, in a cinema, in a lovely little cinema in a place called Albany, which is just north of Berkeley. Had a lovely evening. So the story is, it's set at the start of the Cold War. It's 1945. It's a Polish musical director who is putting together this kind of ensemble, kind of a dance troupe and musical troupe, which are going to tour Poland, and then they tour the communist countries because they're actually very good, and they actually go to the West. He defects after 5 or so years they have this trip to East Berlin, and he just walks through, I'm going to say Checkpoint Charlie, but it was Russian Shoulders, so whatever the Russian checkpoint was, because you could just walk through. And he just walks through, and he ends up in Paris, and he becomes a jazz pianist. And it's his story with one of his students, who, she's not young, so there's no ethical reason for them not to be together and stuff. She's like in her 20s and whatever, and dare say it's a different time. And it's their love affair over 15 years with them being in different countries, and what they do to end up to be together. It's shot in black and white. The lighting is wonderful. The composition of every shot sometimes it can get with a lot of those films that they're overly staged in terms of composition. This wasn't quite like that, but it was beautifully shot, beautifully staged, very captivating. It's Polish, but it had the complete and utter sensibilities of a French film from the 70s and 80s, because really it's about slightly tortured love and around creativity. Lots of kind of like great music and stuff. And the opening montage, which is brilliant, where he's traveling around war-torn Poland and he's recording locals singing folk tunes. And that sounds, it sounds like, oh my God, that sounds so dull and unworthy. But it's a beautiful, haunting little sequence at the start. You don't know where the hell this film is going. So it's called Cold War. Utterly lovely. If it's at a cinema near you, it's not going to be a multiplex because of the very nature of it and stuff, please go and watch it, because it is awesome.
Lovely.
A lovely twist at the end. What she does to be with him, you're like, what? I didn't see that coming. And then it does call back to something which happens at the start. So that's my takeaway the last 7 days. So,
have you seen a film called Blue Monday? Have you seen a film called Blue Monday?
No, I haven't.
It's about 20, 25 years old now, I think. But it's set in Newcastle. And it's a very young Sean Bean and Sting. But the reason I bring it up is it's one of the sort of plots is all based around a Polish jazz band that come over to play in the jazz club that Sting runs. And it's a lovely little film. So I thought if you like that, you may well enjoy Blue Monday.
You know what? I'm going to give that a bit of a watch. It has to be said that I've been, as I said kind of at the start of me talking about this, that I'm not going to say I've been blockbustered out, because I haven't, right? But I need to reconnect with the types of films that, the types of films kind of my youth, really, and films which aren't always about incredibly high stakes on a global scale. There is something very magical about making something incredibly small and personal and intimate, and you just get into the mind of that person or the people, the couple kind of concerned. And I love all of that. And so I'm going to give Blue Monday a bit of a watch. And if I don't like it, I'll come back and I'll cuss you.
Blame me.
Exactly.
That works for me.
All right. So just generally what we do here to wrap up is we just say to our guests, what have you been up to recently and how can people find you on social media?
So I have been writing a lot, and I largely journalism, but I'm also trying to write possibly a play, possibly a screenplay, possibly both, maybe a novel, who knows. You can find me on Twitter. I'm Emma_Burnell_. And you can see a picture of me dressed in a 1950s Americana. So that's quite fun.
And folks, if you want to follow me on social media, specifically Twitter, I always say there's no real reason to, because I hardly ever talk about politics. But if you want to follow me talking about maps and other ephemera, you can follow me on Twitter, where I'm at Royfield, which is R-O-I-F-I-E-L-D. And of course, we are Mid-Atlantic Show, though again, it's tumbleweed there because I don't really post. But if you just want to go, I'll just kind of support them just because, and you never know, they might say something of note and of worthiness one day. It's at Mid-Atlantic Show on Twitter. That's us.
I should warn some of your American listeners that while I will talk about both British and American politics, you'll also find quite a lot about the British soap opera Emmerdale on my feed. So that's just a warning for you.
That is the wrong rural soap. You know, I knew you and I had to fall out. You know, we spent the whole last hour.
We had to disagree on something.
You know, the Archers, if you're going to do rural soaps, if you're going to do farming, it's all about the Archers. Everybody knows that. It's authentic. It's the original. And Emmerdale is just a blatant copy.
See, that's the Midlands in you.
No, it's not. It's not. It's like fact. The Archers is 1952. What's Emmerdale? The mid-70s? Come on now. They've only just started doing it. It's just warming up into it.
Those of us who were born in the mid-70s feel that this is perfectly old enough.
Good answer, you. Are we going to see you again? You're going to come on again?
I'd love to.
Brilliant. And this is Emma. We loved having you on. This has been Mid-Atlantic, folks. It's somewhat of a changing of the guard. Don't forget, good politics is right politics. Be good to each other and basically let that inform the way that you see the world. Be open and inclusive to all. Some people are born with a silver spoon in their mouth. Some people aren't. And the people that aren't, it isn't their fault that they haven't been. Take care. We see you all again soon. Bye-bye.
Brilliant,
there
thank you.
There you go. You're awesome, I like
really
you.
I really enjoyed that, thank you. Oh, thank you.
Dwa serduszka, cztery oczy. Oj, 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 co płakały we dnie w nocy, oj, oj, oj. Czarne oczka, co płaczecie, że się spotkać nie możecie, że się spotkać nie możecie. Mnie matula zakazała, oj, 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 żebym chłopca nie kochała, oj, oj, oj. A ja chłopca chaps za szyję, będę kochać póki żyję, będę kochać.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.